Okay. All right. today is April 19th, 2023, and this is Sarah Desick interviewing Miguel Ramirez for Landmark West about San Juan Hill. And do I have your consent to record this interview for the Landmark West archives?
By all means, yes, you do.
Thank you. So can you start by saying your name and giving yourself a brief introduction?
So my name is Miguel Ramirez, and I'm a twin, and I'll be 68 years old this week, and we grew up coming from Puerto Rico straight to San Juan Hill, which is now Lincoln Center. And we grew up in that neighborhood right there.
Thanks. All right. Can you tell me a little bit about, you mentioned that your family came straight from Puerto Rico. Can you tell me a little bit about your ancestors there and what kind of role they had in your family?
Okay, my mother came from a family of 10, and it was a very caring, loving family. They were all very close to each other. There were brothers and sisters on both sides, and my mother has five kids. Well, four from Puerto Rico, and the fifth kid came later on many years. But she came to New York for a better life and opportunity, because it was hard for them in Puerto Rico. It was very poor, and the jobs were, they were desperate, and they didn't, and they didn't pay that well, and it was a struggle. So my mother came here for a better opportunity with the four of us.
And what part of Puerto Rico did you come from?
From the west side of the island, it's a town called, it's called San German, but in Spanish it's pronounced San Germán. And it's a beautiful town. It has one of the oldest church in the whole Caribbean, and it's called La Portachelli, which is a very famous church, and the town too is a beautiful little town.
So, what were some of your earliest memories?
I remember that we lived on 161st Street in Amsterdam, and I remember it was a very old tenement. And we live in a one bedroom studio on the first floor. And the bathroom was, there wasn't a bathroom in the apartment. The bathroom was down the hallway. So it was a shared bathroom for the entire floor. And I remember there was two beds. My mother and my sister slept in one bed, and me and my brothers, we slept in the other bed. And I remember around the whole room, there were holes, cracked ceilings. There were holes everywhere, and I remember at times you could see the rats going through the walls, and all that kind of stuff, and roaches, and it was a very tight space for us. But we, although it was tight, but we were all very close to each other.
What kind of things did your family do together?
Oh, we would go a lot. I remember going to Central Park, and we used to run and play, and they used to have big rocks. But for that time, it was considered big rocks, but they were like 4 3 feet high. And when I remember, we used to climb, me and my sister and brother, we used to climb there and jump over the, jump to the ground, and we all thought we were superheroes and all that, and my mother would take us to the school playground, which was like down the block.
Can you tell me a little bit about the school that you went to?
Oh, I went to school in the Lower East Side, but my brother Gus and Maggie, they're the ones that went to the elementary school down the block, because we were like like 2.5 or 3 years old. So when they moved us out of the projects, they moved us to the Lower East Side.
Okay. So, can you tell me about some of the other places that you remember from the San Juan Hill
Oh, sure.
neighborhood?
I remember, I think it was because of Thanksgiving Day for parade. Like, the waiting area was like where we lived. So we would see a lot of flows, and I remember, I never forgot it. It was the PT-09. It was like a humongous ship on four wheels, and they came out the block. I said, wow, it was big and tall, and I was amazed. And there was a guy in the front with an American flag. And waving, and then he waved to us, and it was really nice. And then there was a lot of different floats, and they were waiting online. And this happened like two or three times throughout. I mean, in different years, and that's something that I always remember. And there was a guy that, an American guy, that will always be. When we grew up, there's always steps. There were steps. And the steps are known where everybody used to hang out, and even today, I live in South Jersey. I make sure that my house in the front has steps, because I got that from that. And it was a place where you hear great stories. People talk about their lives and all that stuff. And there was a guy, he's an American guy, tall guy, very skinny, and I forgot his name. But me and my twin brother Harry, we used to call him "Hey You," and he always responded to us. We said, "Hey You, how are you? How are you?" And all that. Those are one of the things that that I remember. And there was all kinds of there were African Americans, Latinos, and whites, and I remember we all mingled with each other, even like in the late 50s.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit more about I guess who the other kids were on the block, who else lived in your building?
They were I remember in the building there were African Americans and also many Hispanics too, and me and my brother, we were like more of the younger crowd. There was a lot of older kids than us. And I remember, since we left, we lived on the first floor. My mother would always have the window open. We'll be yelling, "Hey, what's up? This and that." We were our friends from the window, and we were always in diapers. I remember we were always in diapers and t-shirts, and it was just it was great, but a little bit strange because of the we had to be. I remember my mother told us, "Be careful you go to the bathrooms," because it was a first floor and share bathroom, and anybody, the doors, the buildings, they have no locks back then, so anybody from the street could go in. So you have to be careful back then. And we lived it, and it was San Juan Hill, which I didn't know back then, but it was known as the worst neighborhood in the city of New York, but the most diverse community back then.
Do you remember people speaking different languages?
Just mainly English and Spanish. Yeah.
And what about in your home? What language did everyone
Oh,
speak?
it was good. If you said that, we're 100% Puerto Rican. My mother always talked to him in Spanish. And for I mean, well, we started talking Spanish, but as the years got, as we grew up and everything, she always talked in Spanish, and we answer her in English, because we understand what she was saying and all that. But growing up like in the projects, it was mainly English that we spoke, but we understood Spanish well. We understood what my aunts and uncles said, my grandmother, my grandfather. We understood it, but we spoke English most of the time.
And what kind of work did your mom do?
We were, for many years, we were on welfare. And the welfare was the one who, to be honest with you, because it was my mother and five kids. So we didn't have a father. So to me, my father was the welfare department. And even now, when I speak to my friend, they say, where are you from? I grew up in the original place where Lincoln Center was. And then they would talk about prayers. I said, no, I had a mother, 5 years. Well, who's your father? I said, my father was the welfare department. And it was correct because they gave us the food, the rental money, and then the government surplus cheese came in a box, and we all loved that because my mother would make grilled cheese sandwiches and all of that, and they would give us peanut butter jelly and lard and meats in the can. It was, it was for free, and it was wonderful. I myself appreciated that.
Did your mom make Spanish food too?
Oh yeah, she always made for us. We grew up in rice and beans. And it took us a while to learn how to eat lettuce and tomatoes and all that. Because at that, toddler age, we never liked that. My mom used to put it there, but we never ate it. So, but later in life, we learned how to, and it was fun. And it was fun, funny, and it was kind of embarrassing because when she made rice and beans, she had to have a point. The rice here and the beans there. And she'll give the spoon a fork. And I never knew you're supposed to mix it. The rice all separate and the beans separate. Until one day my brother pushed me and the beans went from from this side to the white rice. And it was all in the mix. And then I told him, I don't want to eat it. Look what Harry did. So no, you're gonna eat it, taste it, taste it. And I ate it, and for the first time, I knew how to eat rice and beans together, and it was a great taste, and that is something that 95% of the Puerto Ricans eat rice and beans.
I never thought about little kids even separating. Kids like to separate their food, but I never thought about the rice and beans separate. How old were you when you realized that?
Oh, I was about 3 years old. Yeah. And then later in life, I worked at a childcare center. And I remember it was the same thing what I saw. So I had to teach the kids and play games. Look, if you move this here, you look this, you're going to get a great super taste. And that's how we used to encourage the kids at daycare how to mix the food and give it a taste test. And we used to talk to Tom. First, taste it. If you like it, eat it. If you don't like it, then you don't have to eat it. But you have to taste it. It's important that we're learning about different kinds of foods.
So when you were just a little kid like that, how big, did you ever go outside of the
Oh,
neighborhood? How far outside did you go?
my mother would just let it go in the front and also to the corner, but supervised. Like my sister and brother, they used to go all around. But me and my brother were twins. We were like three years old. So we used to hang a lot on the steps, on the windowsill, and also when my mother took us to the corner of the store, or my brother's sister. But she wouldn't. She was always my mother. Always was looking out the window all the time, looking in for our safety and who we play with and all of that. And I remember the streets. We used to use a lot of the trucks, the white trucks, and we used to make designs. And the kids used to play Skeldy, but I don't know how to play that, but I remember watching them.
What is the game called?
Skelzies.
What's that?
It's like a big square with different numbers, and then you take I give you an example, like if it's about a bottle cap, you go like this, and then it'll shoot. And the thing is that you go to the you follow the number order. So number one was down the square, so you will go there, and then you will try to get inside the box. And once you get in the box, then you will go to the next number, two and three. And I think 12 was the end. And the first one to finish the whole thing would win.
Wow, thank you. So I wanted to ask you about if you remember the sounds of the neighborhood. Was it noisy? Was there music?
There was always I remember hearing police cars, fire departments, and horns from trucks and buses. And then I remember a lot of kids running around a lot with their bikes and screaming and yelling. I remember seeing some fights, but it wasn't more fights, more like arguments. And it was like all the kids pushing each other and yelling at each other. But I really don't remember seeing like fist fights and all that. Although we lived in a really, really bad neighborhood. But I guess in my block we were one of the lucky ones.
So your building was relatively calm.
A lot of traffic. Meaning people hang out in the front, a lot of times going in and out. And I do remember my older brother Gus. He had asthma. So because there were a lot of holes in the walls, the roaches were considered as an asthma trigger for my brother. So he was always going to Roosevelt Hospital because he always get an asthma attack. So the triggers, because there was lead, mice, roaches, and all that, all these open holes that the department had, there were a lot of cracks. And you could see the studs on the walls and all that. And because there was mice and rats, the urine smells and all that, those were big asthma triggers for my brother, that he always got sick and kept going to the emergency room many times. And I remember my mother would take all of us to the emergency room because my older brother used to get an asthma attack and he would run out of air and all that.
Yeah, that
And we
sounds really difficult.
too, us too. We were all, the thing was that growing up there, we would all take turns going to the hospital. The hospital was like a common visit for my mother.
We're
And
all.
she always took care of us, and she used to make her own, Puerto Rican medicine stuff, like eggs with a mica drink, and she used to mix it, and she used to call it a ponche drink, and a ponche drink is it's like a super vitamin healer drink, and we would drink it, and we would feel better. It was like a very cheap, low energy drink to do.
Do you know what was in it?
Yeah, there was egg, milk, and there's a soda called Mita, which is a typical Spanish soda that many of the Spanish people use. And my mother will, pour it in there with the milk and the egg, a raw egg, and put it in there, and she will mix it and make it into like a smoothie. And I remember it was purple, the color purple. And we would drink it. We would drink it, and then for us, that was like a homemade vitamin, and it did help us.
Yeah, sounds good. Were there, did she have things that she'd make for you when you were sick with a cold or something?
She like I remember, like, because we were all hyper kids. She was single. We all hyper kids. And the fact that my brother had asthma, that makes you much, much more hyper. So it was one girl and three boys. So we were constantly always running around and jumping and all that, and during the night time. So sometimes we couldn't sleep, so we were active. So my mother would boil water, like in a little pot. And then she would put a piece of lettuce inside the water would be boiled. And I was told that would help you sleep better. It was like a tea, but with a little sweetened tea. And she would make us drink it, and that would help us relax and take us through the night. But that was like a homemade, medicine that she used to do, and that was common with many of the Puerto Rican families, because when I was older, the kids would tell me the same thing while what the parents did.
Wow, I'd never heard of that one before. Was there any sense of like the families on the block helping out, watching each other's kids or anything like
Yeah.
that?
I remember my mother had a couple of friends, and they were always constantly talking, hanging out in the front. And I remember playing with kids, but not my age, older kids. And some of the kids were tough, you know, like bully kids. But you know, that's something that you got used to it.
Was there a lot of cars that would drive through on the streets too, or was it mostly just kids hanging out?
There was always traffic. It was a one-way street. So, and those and you had to be careful because we used to play in the streets. But when the car came, you know, we knew we had, you had to move back and let the car go. We only went to the park when my mother took us, which it wasn't that much, but she did take us.
Was there anything like church or like a club or anything that you would do together?
There was a Catholic church down, a big one down. I think it was towards Amsterdam Avenue, and I remember, I vaguely remember, we used to go there at times. The Spanish mass, so they had Spanish mass there, and I remember hearing the choir singing like in an echo, and that was the church cathedral, and it had a beautiful sound, and that's something I always remember, was that sound, was a warm. Warming sound, and also too, they were back then. That was also a famous place for jazz. They were, we were too young, you heard it, but that spot there had a lot of great jazz clubs. There were a lot of great jazz musicians that I learned when I got older, you know, and which I never knew that. So we were in it. We was poor, it was rough, but it was great things happening, like the jazz music, which was very popular in that area.
Do you remember hearing people listening to music on the radio?
Spanish stations, yeah. My mother used to have a little radio, and it was mainly like in Spanish at that time. But when we got to move through projects, and we started, you know, doing English and all that.
You mentioned there were a lot of kids around. Were there any neighbors that you remember that were older? Who'd been there for like in the neighborhood for a long time?
No, I don't remember anything, but since I'm a classical musician, a trained musician, so one day, this was like maybe like 8 years ago. I was watching Leonard Bernstein doing the West Side Story with opera singers, which was, that's something that was never done. And one of the opera singers that sang in that show, she was talking about her life, and she said, "I grew up on 61st Street, and this is where my parents lived." And she was like a part of the opera cast they had with with such story that they did a video with Leonard Bernstein. And I was amazed. I said, "Oh my God, that lady came from the same block that I grew up in." Because she said 61st Street on the west side where Lincoln Center is now.
Wow, do you know her name?
No, but she's on YouTube and she does mention that.
Oh wow. So is there I want to ask about when you had to move.
Okay, yeah.
So how did that, I mean, I know you were young, but what do you remember about that time?
That I remember my mother took us to these projects, and she said, "This is where we're going to live." And one of the early things I remember, the projects are called Villa Houses in the Lower East Side, in the 6-story buildings. And I remember somebody from the office took me and my mother and all of us to the 6th floor, and they opened the door, and they said, "This is where we're going to be living soon." So It was a two-bedroom apartment with a little dining area in the living room and a bathroom, and two bedrooms. And I remember when we walked in the house, we saw a closet with shelves, and there were like 3 or 4 foot shelves. And me and my brother, we all thought that those were bumpers. So we would say, "Ma, I want this bed. I want that bed. I want that bed." And we were arguing, fight, who's gonna sleep where? Then my mother explained to it. That's not bumping, that's the closet. We thought have those were beds and everything like that. And it was so nice to look around. And when you look around, there were no holes in the walls, you know. It was painted, it was fresh paint and all that. And there was a stove, a kitchen, and a bathroom. The bathroom was like a luxury thing to have. Then my mother told us that in a couple of weeks we'll be moving here. But then my mother told me too that they were telling her like for a couple of months that everyone is black has to move out because they're gonna change the neighborhood. And I think that what's his name? David Ross or Mitchell Ross. He was in charge of the architect of that whole neighborhood. And they took all these people who've been living there for years and they scattered them all around the city. Yeah. And now that I think about it, I love the Lower East Side, but I have a question: how come we couldn't move there, like a couple of blocks away? They have the Amsterdam houses.
Yeah,
the public houses. And I was told by myself, how nice could it have been if I could have lived there and gone to the music schools here. But living the Lower East Side was great neighborhood for me. It was wonderful because you had all kinds of culture there. You had the Italians, the Puerto Ricans, the Jewish people, the Colombians, the African American, the Chinese, and we all went to school together and we all got along with each other. It was really an amazing time back then. And every what was nice about that is at an early age you learn about the many different cultures and the styles and where people came from and the way they behave, because each culture had different ways of presenting and behaving themselves. Like an example, the Chinese kids were very calm and very quiet, so in the classroom they they would talk but relax. With the blacks and Hispanics, we were all over hyper jump, talking loud and pushing and getting around it. And then we had several of the Hispanic Jews there in the classroom, and they were well behaved, very very polite, and all that. And it was mainly us the black and Hispanic, but more of the rowdy type, and daring type too.
So. You're basically everyone who was living on your block got a letter that said, this is where you're going to be moving.
Right, right, right.
So
right.
Your mom didn't have any choice in where you guys ended up.
Right, right, right. Yeah, she, I guess back then there were caseworkers and they came and they assigned, they did the paperwork and they said, you got to report to this place. And that's how we wind up going in the Lower Side.
Were there other people from your neighborhood that ended up living where you were living?
Oh, you know what? I because we didn't know them, but I never heard anybody who came from the Lincoln Center area.
Mm-hmm. And did your, oh, go ahead.
Now that I know where San Juan Hill is and the Lincoln Center was built, for me, that was like an honor. I said, wow, I lived there one time. And they turned it into a humongous music land for all coaches to perform and share, their gifts. And even up to many times now, I go back and I walk around Lincoln Center and say, wow, it's amazing what they did here.
You said it was an honor to have lived in the place where that was built.
Yeah. And the thing was that me living there, I felt like I did a circle. Because growing up in The law is like at an early age, I learned how to play the tuba.
Yeah, can you just explain how that happened? And
Okay.
yeah.
We had this like a Mother Teresa young white teacher, and she loved minority kids. She had a passion for them. So when my brother, this was PS 31, which was the school across the street from where we lived, and my brother went there when he got to fifth grade. He was in music class and he played the clarinet. And the teacher's name was Miss White, and Miss White was like a dream teacher to have. She was very hip, gracious, talented, smart, and loving. Then when my brother left, then my sister Maggie, she went to music class too, and Maggie played the tuba, which was a rare thing for a female to do. And my sister Maggie was a really good tuba player. She went through the whole string. She played with the York City High School Orchestra. She went to Michigan High School. She was very, very talented, and she used to play, many groups. And she could have gone to Juilliard, but she decided to go into social work and wind up going on a full scholarship to Cornell University. And then she wind up going on another scholarship to do her master's in public health at NYU. And then she ran a hospital. She ran the Helen Hayes Hospital upstate New York. She was the first Latino Hispanic di director in charge of the whole hospital. And then I came in, and I played the tuba. My sister told the music teacher, Miss White, to listen to my brother because she said, "I think he has really real talent." So I was in the fourth grade, and the fifth grade is a band class. So Miss White told me to come upstairs and play the tuba, and I played it. And she was impressed. So I started playing with the band in the fourth grade. And I never forgot that. And playing the tuba was a major part in my life because I lived in a troubled neighborhood, and a lot of the kids, they didn't have motivation in their life. So many of them got lost at an early age. And I remember the fighting, the little gangs they used to have, kids getting high, getting hurt, and all that stuff. And the music, it drew me aside. Like when I was 11 or 12, then I started focusing more on music, and it kept me off the streets because, although we all lived in a housing project like this, you really didn't have much of a choice of friends to hang out because it was a troubling neighborhood, and there was all kind of cultures there. So the music part opened the doors for me for many places. In fact, look, I'm showing something here. I used to be in North City High School Orchestra, and you see we say Lincoln Center, Avery Fisher Hall in the bottom. I'm very proud to say that I played with North City High School Orchestra, and that was like a prestige thing to do. My sister played there first, and then when she left, I took her place. And that to me, that was like an honor. That was something special because only the best got to play in the orchestra. And in the All City High School Orchestra, there's only one tuba player. So when you're auditioning, you're going like in competition with 20 other kids. And I was so proud because I would say, "Damn, I come from the Lower East Side, poor neighborhood, and I got picked to play with the orchestra."
How did you get to like what were all the different programs that you ended up doing? Like, what did it look like to play music when you were in school? Like, is there after school stuff? How did you get the instrument?
I used well. Let me tell you a sad part. I used to hang out with a lot of trouble kids, and I remember the park across the street from where we lived in the Pratt Projects. The school PS 31 had a playground in the back, and my friends used to go there. Now I'm talking about I was like in sixth grade, and And I had these real good friends, but they, you know, they didn't have any goals and stuff like that. And I remember the when I used to be in the park, the some of my friends, you know, I was friends with them, but I never participated in stuff they did. So an example was we were in the park, and the kids would take a black cat by the tail and swing it, and just throw it, and I was so surprised. And because the neighborhood had a lot of drugs and all that, there were needles all over the park. So some of the friends I have, they would take pick a needle and inject in the bird and watch the bird fly, and you could see the bird was out of control. And you know, I knew at an early age that that was wrong. You know, we shouldn't have that. And that's why I get credit to my mother, because my mother told her to be careful of this and that, and she told the difference between right and wrong. And that's why when I got the tool, it was more like a safe haven place. So slowly I kept practicing and getting involved with a lot of the groups. I went to the Henry Street Settlement, which is one of the founding institutions in the history of America. I went there as a kid. I got involved in the music program. And then later in life, I taught there. I worked in the childcare program, and I loved it. I had all these Chinese kids, and the kids were the ones that taught me how to speak Chinese. And the at the day kid, there were very few people who spoke Chinese, and because the kids taught me how to speak Chinese, I was many times were able to help the parents and say this, go here, go there, do this, and then I was able to say go to the bathroom, thank you, and good morning, sit down, how are you? Was and the kids would cry, and I would say no more, how mama like, and that meant that don't cry, your mommy's coming, and all that. So it was nice that the kids would make fun of me when I was learning how to make China, you know, play to speak Chinese. But the kids, it was funny. I worked in China, but the kids really taught me how to speak Chinese because half of the kids there were, you know, from Chinese backgrounds. It was nice. And then playing the tuba, I went to the Henry Street Music School. I went to the Third Street School Music School. And then I was able to play with. In junior high school, I got scholarships to go to music camps. I was able to play like with the All City. I mean, the Manhattan Burwai was a gifted program for advanced junior high school musicians. So I went through their program, then the All City, and then I was very fortunate to go to the Juilliard Preparatory for program, and I got a full scholarship, and I just want to share this. This was my music teacher, my tuba teacher. He was a tuba
Oh,
for 30 years at the New York Philharmonic,
oh, wow.
and I was able to get a full scholarship at the age of 16. And
Wow.
the funny thing was that they told me for your lesson, go up to room 523. So my appointment was at 2 o'clock with the tuba teacher. My first lesson, I never had tuba lessons. So and then so I was curious. I opened the door and there was nobody there. So I sat down. I started to warm up, and I didn't. I was just warming up. And nobody goes behind me. Excuse me, that's very good. And it was him. And I remember him because I used to watch the young people's concert for years. And I said, damn, one day I want to meet this guy. And his name is Joseph Novotny. He passed away, but he was like the top of the top. You know, when you play tuba, if you study with him, you were lucky because he was in demand. And he was very popular, and then he picked his own students. So the fact that I was in the Juilliard pre college, I was able to study with him. And what shocked me the most was that I was in the orchestra too, and the orchestra was amazing. There were kids, you know, from all over the city, but the majority of them were Asian kids, and they were well trained, played violin, cello, and bass really good. So we were playing Brahms second, and the thing was that. I don't know if you know about classic music, Brahms second. famous lullaby. Right, so I was playing in the orchestra. Well, suddenly the strings, the violin, the cello. I was crying because it was such a beautiful sound. And here I'm saying, I came from this native word. You know, like at an early age, I was able to, you know, to know the difference. And then sometimes in my mind, I will get shocked and I go back to Lower East Side. And, you know, a lot of destruction, disorganized. And every Saturday, I would go to Julia School. And it was all day, you know, lesson. You go theory, dictation, orchestra, and tuba lesson. And I did it for one whole year. And it was like the greatest part of my entire life to go there. And the music was so beautiful inside the rehearsal room. The sound of the orchestra, the sound they got. It's hard to express, but it was like being in heaven. And knowing the fact that, you know, this is my neighbor. I'm playing. I grew up, you know. It was a unique experience, and I got to play with many of the great student orchestra around the city. I got to play, and one of the hardest parts was for me that when I got to college, the fact that we were on welfare and we were poor, I didn't have a tuba, so I used to play tuba by making contract with a lot of the. Like Kingsborough College, NYU, Brooklyn College, all that. I used to tell them, look, let me do your tuba and I will do your concert for you. And that was the exchange. So I was doing that a lot. And it was hard for me to go to a major school, a great school, and I was on a scholarship, but I didn't have an instrument. And the school kept on, oh, no, you have to provide for that. And it was very difficult before. For me to do that, because, you know, I didn't go like to music around high school where you learn all the fundamentals. So when I went to the Julia preschool, I did the dictation, sight singing, and orchestra arranging, and that was something I was never taught, and it was hard for me. And there was a theory teacher, her name was Miss Goldstein. She was like 95 years old, And she would tell me, you gotta come in. And I was shy, I'll take the back. And then she said, where's your book? I thought, oh, I don't have the book, but I'll try to get one. And then next week her name was Miss Goldstein. She'd been there to Julia for years. And she taught both the upper school and the preschool. And she came in, she brought all my theory books. I said, I can't afford this. She said, No, don't worry, this is for you. Because of her, I learned a lot of the theory, dictation, and the sight singing. And that was, for me, that was very, very touching to know that an old Jewish lady, where I grew up too in a Jewish neighborhood, she, you know, she provided that for me. That, for me, those are things that I will never forget.
Yeah. So you, let me get this straight. you didn't have a tuba, and you didn't have a lesson until the Juilliard program that you were in high school. And then when you got to college, you had to essentially work by playing in other orchestras in order to gain access to a tuba.
To browse. And then what happened? Well, there's something that you need to know too, that drawing while living in the projects at the age of eight years old, my mother used to send us to a program called University Solomon Camp. And they took all these poor kids and sent them up to Beacon, New York. And it was a sleepaway camp for 3 weeks. And my brother, my sister, and my twin brother, we all went there. And one of the most beautiful things in life was that, which I don't know, I learned about it later, was that Pete Seeger was the one in charge of the whole music world. So we learned... you know, like, we shall overcome, we have all the flowers down blowing in the wind. And those are all beautiful songs. And later in life, they were telling me, oh, he was teaching you all the protest songs and all that. But it was when we were eat at 6 o'clock, and about 500 kids, we will all go to a little amphitheater. and we all sat there, and Pete Seeger came with two guys, the banjo and two guys, one guitar and another banjo. And they will teach us all these songs. And it, to me, from 6 to 7, it was called Council. And that's where, you know, where all the kids come after they eat and they sing and then they go back to their bunks. And to me, that was a beautiful time. So, and then every year, my mother did that like for 3 or 4 years. But the second year, I went there. Before you go to camp, you have to have a physical. So my brother had, my sister had it, and then I came there, my physical. And then it was a female doctor. She listened to me, and she told my mother, you know, your son needs to be tested because we hear a different sound in the heart. So, and then they took me to NYU. They test me and all that. And then I never forgot when they took x-rays of me, and then they put me in the waiting room for the doctor to come in. My mother was outside, I guess, filling out papers. Then it would, back then there were intern young doctors, like the car. So he came in the room, and he tells me, hey, he puts on the x-ray and on the light and all that, and he looks at the picture of my heart. He goes, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. And I told him, what's wrong? And he goes, you have this, your heart is so close to the bone that you could die. And then I got scared, and then I started to panic, and I cried. My mother came, what's wrong? And my mother was very dominant, she was very strong. Hey, you could play with kids, because she was very protective. And I told mom, the doctor told me I'm going to die. What? So, yeah, then my mother screamed at the doctor, saying, how could you tell him that? You know, and then he apologized. But then, to make a long story, was that at the age of 8, my heart was the size of a man.
Mm.
So they had to give me medication to bring it down to its normal size. And eventually they did, but I was excused because of the heart condition. I was excused from all heavy sports, all kinds of stuff. I used to have an elevator pass to go to all the floors instead of taking the stairs. And my brother, my twin brother, would take my card and fake it and take the elevator too. And one day we got caught, and the lady screamed at me, and I explained to her, I have a twin, and they were all shocked, And then so they had to do like a little dot on me to know who was who. So like from 8 years on, I was always restricted to do all kinds of sports. So that's why I dedicated all my life to doing music. But the interesting thing though, because I learned this at a later age, because of the heart problems I had, it created a lot of anxiety, and it gave you panic attacks. Now I didn't know that. So I remember in junior high school, especially in the high school, I was sitting in the English class, and it was like 10 o'clock in the morning, and I used to hate to go to that class because I was hyperventilating, and then I would get a panic attack, and I would get so nervous. I would raise my hand, and say, I have to go to the bathroom. She goes, you always have to go to the bathroom, and it wasn't I had to go to the bathroom. It's I had to run real fast. I would run down the hallway to catch up to the beat of my heart, because I just felt that, I was going to faint. And it was that was a problem due to my heart then. But nobody told me, and I never knew, but I learned that in my late 20s. I saw the cardiologist. I used to be monitored by the cardiologist twice a year, and the doctor told me, Do you get anxiety? I said, yeah, how'd you know that? He told me, no, because that's part of your condition that you have. And I was so shocked, and it brought back a lot of memories, because I thought for me, if I was to say that, mom, I got this and this, in my mind, I thought that they're going to take me to Bellevue, the mental ward, and leave me there. And that was my biggest fear, that I didn't want to go to Bellevue. Yeah, because the anxiety attack, I was sweating and everything. My fingers would get, very, very, watering, went down playing the tuba. And the teacher told me, no, when you play this thing, you play two notes. And she went like this. She goes, oh my God, what's wrong with you? And my hand was sweaty. And it was because of the anxiety. But I never knew that at all until I was older. And then it gave me, and what happened, when the doctor told me that a couple of years later, all my sweaty stuff, it went away. Because I guess I learned to be it. And there's another part too. When I was in high school, I used to come home. My mother that time was a nurse's aide. She worked at government hospital. The welfare helped her get a full-time job. So when I was 12 years old, every time I come from my house, I would listen to Beethoven. And we had a big stereo. We had to hear it loud. Then so my mother come. Now I'll be like this, just sitting down for hours. Just listening. The mother said, what's wrong? What's wrong? I said, no, my nothing. And then she was saying, which, because she didn't understand, because she thought that listening to Beethoven, Mozart, and all that was funeral music. And she would tell me, why are you so depressed? Why are you listening to this with her? I said, my noise. No, no. So she got scared, and she made me see a psychologist. And I saw the psychologist, and I told her what I was doing. And then the next day, he told my mother, listen, nothing wrong with your son. What he's doing is beautiful. He has a gift. Let him do that. She said, well, what you want to do? Go outside and play all these strong kids? He's doing something beautiful. He's educating himself, and also he's nurturing himself how to, you know, be balanced and calm down his nerves. So ever since, my mother never, you know, bothered me with that. And then in my 20s, I was playing like a lot of orchestra groups, and we were on 14th Street. And we had like a big orchestra, and the conductor got late. So the lady said, who knows how to conduct? And for years, I always had that passion and love. And when she said that, I felt like this. Okay, Miguel, come up front. She said, do you know West Side Story? Now, in my mind, I knew it, I always knew it by heart. But I never talked about it, I never shared with it. But I knew all the parts of my heart. So she goes, can you conduct what I saw? I said, yeah, I know the whole piece, I know everything. So I started to conduct, and everybody clapped for me, because they were surprised. I did the whole thing, and I knew all the parts and all that. And then the conductor came back, he told me, he goes, Miguel, where'd you learn how to conduct like that? And I told him, I said, I used to watch Leonard Bernstein every week. And that was my role model. I learned from that. Then as the years went by, I went to the, you know, band school, meet the Juilliard school and all that. And that was when it's hard for me, because I didn't have the two. And many times I cried and I got depressed, because I'm saying, I was saying, damn, I'm hitting a major, you know, music concert, and I don't have an instrument. So to make a long story short, I was in band school music, playing in the orchestra. And when you play in the orchestra, they have to audition you. So I was competing with a lot of kids, and I got picked to play in the orchestra. And then about 2 weeks later, I'm in the orchestra, and I'm sitting down where I sit, and the conductor says, where's your instrument? And I told him, I don't have one today, but I will have one next week for sure. Because I used to run around getting instruments. And then they had replaced me. And I was so sad and upset. Because, you know, being in the orchestra, that's a prestige, especially if you're a two player. And, you know, that means that you're good and you compete a lot of people. So they replaced me. And I was depressed. And I was crying. And I got depressed. So I had to leave the school, because I was depressed. And then my grades went down. And then they told me, you're on academic probation. But they didn't understand that I didn't have a tutu. And it was hard for me. So to make a long story short, they kicked me out of the school because of my academic grades, that I couldn't keep up with the program. And a lot of it too was my anxiety, and also my, you know, not having instruments. So I wound up working in, you know, in the childcare center. That's, you know, it helped me a lot. I got married and all that stuff. And then I came to Philadelphia, and I worked in the Hispanic community for years. I worked with different big Hispanic large organization. I did mental health. I did. I ran a childcare program. I worked in a light music school. I was on the board members for many of the community agencies. And then I was from moving from New York City in my 20s to Philadelphia. It was a major pressure for me because New York, your lifestyle's moving. Philadelphia was a much slower pace. And there was a lot of heavy racism. You could see when you rode the train, the blacks and the whites separate. And when I used to come to the train, I don't know where to sit because you could see it, you know. You could see it. Well, and then I got involved with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I was part of the Cultural Initiative Board. And through that board, we were able, the Philadelphia Orchestra was able to bring in more minority conductors, musicians, concerts. And then I was part of the whole thing. I was very, very active. There was about 20 of us, but I was one of the active ones because I knew about the music. The other people, they didn't play instrument, they didn't understand, but I had the passion and all that. So we were able to get the orchestra to play in Camden for the first time. And we did it 2 years. Then they let me pick the program. It was really, really, really nice. And I worked with them like for 10 years because it was a special grant from the Pew Foundation that they gave to the orchestra to start off a cultural diversity board, because the orchestra for years didn't have my minorities and they didn't draw that crowd. So I'm retired now, and my last day of the job, I was working for the city of Philadelphia in the health service, the department. So I went to see my annual check with the cardiologist, and the same day I retired, my last day that Monday, I was in the hospital, and I had a major heart operation. I had my sister, because she worked with Director Helen Hayes in New York, the hospital. She knew all the top doctors. So I had this doctor named Dr. Girardi, who worked at New York Presbyterian, and he's known as like the top of the top. And he gave me like a 10-hour operation. They took out my heart, and they put in two mechanical valves. They gave me three bypass, and then they took off it's called an aneurysm repair. It's like a main valve that goes to the heart, and that main valve had a pop-up balloon, and they told me that heavy, you could easily die. So they deflated, they sewed it up, and then they gave me a pacemaker too. So this has been 10 years, and I'm still involved with music. I play, I'm in South Jersey. I play with many of the groups, and I'm doing something now that I always loved that I didn't do. I'm taking conducting lessons. And the people who I'm conducting, I could be their great grandfather. And we have, to be honest with you, there's an Asian girl. Her name is Jinan Chang. She's a conductor at Rong University. She teaches the orchestra. And age-wise, we're like almost like 30 years apart. But we communicate so well, like, and you know, she tells me what she learned, and I tell her what I learned, and we both have like different ways to express our stuff. And she even tells me, like, now I know that I could have been instead of being a tutor major, I should have became a conductor. And the reason why, because a conductor, you don't need an instrument, you need the baton. and the conductor is, you are the instrument. But I was shy to show that. And then the other day I was watching CBS for Washington D.C. There's a lady named Tanya Leon. She's a famous conductor and composer. And that was the lady when I went to 14th Street and they told me to come back. She was the one that gave me free lessons because of that. And her name is Tanya Leon, and she. She got the Academy Award, you know, like that's one of the highest awards you can get for conducting, writing, and all that stuff. And for me, that was an honor because that was my first free teacher, and she only gave me two lessons. But I could say, you know, that's my real professional teacher. And then the lady from Ron College, she confirmed it, which I got emotional because she confirmed it. She said, Miguel, you are a conductor. You know your stuff. You have stuff that many conductors have to learn. You have it natural in you. And I was so happy because it was there, but I was afraid to share it. And that's why when I say from 61st, I go back to Lincoln Center, it brought me back. And I just feel that when I went to Julia and all of that, I felt that I went home. Because my neighborhood was in the Lower East Side too, it was rough. There were a lot of my friends, they died, they got shot, they went. In fact, I used to give concerts in Sing Sing, Rikers Island, Bedford Springs. And one time we were in Rikers Island, we were on the stage, and it was a cold winter day. And we were about to play, and I hear somebody go, my name is Spanish Miguel. They call me Mickey. So everybody go, Mickey. I'm looking around, say, Mickey. And it was one of my old friends since childhood. And he was in jail. I haven't seen him for years. And that's where he was all the time. He was in jail. And he was so happy to see me. And I got a little teary-eyed because I said, damn, he's such a kid. I grew up. And he was a smart kid and all that. And he went up with the Ron Brown. There were many kids there, many kids that didn't have the opportunity that I had. I had the music and the Vedic, the motor, you know, the motive to continue. And I had many support systems. I had the church, the Father Burns was a good, you know, we were Catholic, so he always kept in touch. He could encourage us to move. Had Miss White, who always followed us wherever we went. In fact, when my mother got pregnant with my younger sister, Lisa, my mother had to go to Bedfordshire for a week, and Miss White volunteered to watch us in the housing project. So she was our caretaker for a whole week when my mother was giving birth.
Who was that person again? Can you explain?
The what?
Who was that person?
Miss White, our music teacher.
Oh, wow. She was the one who watched you when your mom was in the hospital?
Yeah. And she became my sister's godmother. Because of that, and Miss White for us, she was like our mother Teresa. Yeah, she was like an angel. She always cared for us. She came to my concert. I used to play at yeah. I got you. Can you see the dates on this? Can you see the dates?
I can't see the dates.
Okay, but this is like.
Can you hold it up higher? And a little higher. Oh, I still can't. It's a little too small.
All right, but anyway, this is like 1979. Carnegie Hall, and I remember, you know, I was playing with the Youth Orchestra in New York, and that's another great orchestra that, you know, to be an honor to be in, and they take kids there from 12 to 21. So I was very good in my instrument, and I played. Five seasons we with them, and we used to play three concerts per year at Carnegie Hall. So I don't want to brag. I played it 18 times. Loved it. And we play all the major works, professional, you know, rules. And I remember I invited my teacher, Miss White. We did a piece called Pictures at an exhibition. It's by Maurice Ravel. It's a big Russian piece. And at the end, it's a section called the Great Gate of Kiev. There's a humongous brass then. At the end, she came on and she goes, Miguel, I heard you play. It was so beautiful. You were the only tour player, but you were so loud and powerful. You were representing your community. I was in tears because she came and, you know, she was my teacher in fourth grade. And she was the one who really pushed me, you know, to explore music, stay off the streets and all that. Because back then, the streets were rough, you know. And to give you an example, I was kind of embarrassed being a Puerto Rican because back in the 60s and in the 70s, the newspaper always put down the Puerto Ricans as being crooks and rapists and everything. And that wasn't true. But that was why we were classified. So wherever I went, I was kind of embarrassed to say that I was Puerto Rican. But not now, not to say, oh, it's beautiful to be poor. For Puerto Rican. And I got to thank my mother, because my mother knew a lot of my friends, so she always kept me away from them. And slowly the music just dragged me across and all that. I didn't finish school, but at least in my heart, I could say, I went to Juilliard, went to Mexican music, I played Carnegie Hall 18 times, I got involved with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I'm studying with three different conductors now that I take, and I pay for my lessons. And that's so, and that makes me so proud, because you know, that's something I could never do. And to me, taking conducting the lessons is like being in heaven. I love going for 1 hour. It's like going to a psychiatrist. You talk, you conduct, and they do this, this, and that. I love it because it's selfish fraction. And then they ask you, how do you feel when you do this? Or I express myself, and they all tell me, you're very musical. You have a lot of great talent because you're able to talk and express yourself when you conduct. And they all tell me that's something that takes years to learn, and you know this. So, you know, that was, and that's why I say that from 61st Street, I made a circle. I made a fist. You know, I didn't graduate from Juilliard, but I was there to I got friends that I grew up with that minorities. I have a great friend trump player. He was like an assistant principal French trump player of the New York Philharmonic for years, but he died because of cancer. I have a good friend, another Puerto Rican, that he played first trumpet with the Minnesota Symphony Orchestra, and he grew up on 113th Street in the carpet houses, the housing project, just like I did. I grew up downtown. And they were like 10 great minority players that were super, super good, that we all came from the projects. And I remember one guy named Leslie Donner. He was an African American. He played the clarinet. He wound up going to Oberlin Music College. It's a great, great college. And we grew up together. And there was a conducting audition to go to Tanglewood. To study with Bernstein, all these guys, and me and him were sharing the concerts when we used to play all around the city, because I used to play with the Harlem 30, the Harlem Philharmonic and all that stuff. So Leslie said, "Come on, Miguel, there's an audition for Tanglewood, and Tanglewood's like the best camp in the world to go for classical training for the summer. You go there like for the whole summer." You get private lessons, playing with the orchestra. So, and again, I was shy. No, Leslie, I can't do it. I can't. No, Miguel, you should do it. You should do it. I know you could do it. So he took the audition. I didn't go because I was shy. But he got in. When he came back, he said, Miguel, there were a lot of guys that you were better than, and they got accepted. So you could have got accepted too. So I felt, and now his name is Dr. Leslie Donner, and he conducts all over the world.
What do you think it was that kept you motivated with all the challenges that you had with not having an instrument and having to just work 10 times as hard trying to find an instrument? And
I think the classic music, especially when you listen to Mozart, Tchaikovsky, Beethoven, Wagner, that gave me like a safe haven. Like I knew when I listened to that stuff, I felt home. Like when I used to go to many of the Philharmonic concerts and all that stuff, and I used to go in person. And when I went to that, I just felt like this is where I belong. This is where I belong.
So
and I felt an inner peace.
And you actually went to the places that were built as part of Lincoln Center after they were built?
I got to see Lincoln Center when I was about 13 or 14 years old. But Lincoln Center was already built. But I knew that it was right where Fordham University is. I knew that. And then I remember there was like a big armory Okay, can you hold on for a second?
Yeah.
Be back in a minute. One second.
Yep.
Took a long time, but I just want to share with you, and you're gonna like it. You're gonna like this. It's actually a picture when we lived on 61st Street. This is me and my brother. You see?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, and this was the armory I was talking about. There was an armory on that, either block away or around it, around the block. Now I'm gonna ask you, just take a lucky guess. Which one you think is me? Left or the right?
Ooh, the right?
No, you mean this one?
Yeah.
This is me, because you can see I have a big forehead in the front. This is the way we used to dress in my mother, for Easter and all, for church. This is the way my mother used to dress us.
In little suits.
Yeah, and this was when we were like 3 years old. And this is actually on, at where Lincoln Center is now.
Yeah, wow.
And then these are my grandkids now. And I hang out with them, like I would say about 80% of the time with them. I take them out of parks, we play, we laugh, and all that. And my wife gets a bit embarrassed because I have a lot of great stories that I tell about my life with kids. And the kids like it too. They like to hear my story. So these are my grandkids. Yeah.
So cute.
This one here, this is Riley. She's half Puerto Rican and half Irish. And then and this one here, he's my son, my son married a girl that already had a kid, but that's like his own son, so he's Irish, and the rest are 100% Puerto Rican.
Yeah. Is your wife Puerto Rican?
Yeah, she's from the Lower East Side too. Yeah, but I'm proud to say that I came from the Lower East Side. I love it. I go there a lot and all that. Although my mother passed the other day, let me show you a picture of. I got a picture here. You know this picture here of my mother. I'm gonna blow that and put it here.
That's great. Can you show it to me a little bit closer again?
Sure. This
This.
is Lincoln. I mean, where 61st Street.
Oh, I think it went away from the.
I'm going, ah.
Oh.
Oh, look, I did in a sad time. This is my mother, like the past couple of weeks.
Oh,
She's
yeah.
81 years old. She died of cancer, and she died yesterday.
I'm so sorry.
And for us, we didn't have a mother. I mean, we didn't have a father, but she was. And with the time, she taught us how to be strong, and and she had this thing with the boys that you always have to treat females special. In my life, I was always extra special to any female that was around me. She told that you have to respect females. You can never hit them like that, and that's what we did. And that's the value that my mother taught us. In fact, when I was like 13 years old, starting to like girls, my mother showed me how to hold a girl's hand, what to say, what not to do. And she taught us that. And she taught us that. I want to show you a picture of my brothers and sisters. So you could have an idea. Have you met any of my brothers and sisters yet?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay, because there's Lisa, Maggie. Well, I want to share with you. This is my conducting teacher. She's beautiful, right?
Yeah.
She's at Rowan University, and I love, I study well, you know, once a month, and I love it.
So there's Lisa, Maggie,
Gus.
Harry, and Gus, and you.
Gus is the oldest, and Maggie's next, and they both went to elementary school on 61st Street. We were two, me and Harry were twins, and we were too young to go to school. But we played in the street in our, in all the list.
So I wanted to ask a question just to say you kind of talked about this a little bit here and there, but I wanted to ask you directly, what was the ultimately what was the impact of having to move out of the San Juan Hill neighborhood for you?
Well, I mean, I wish I could have stayed there, and I could have gone to school there, I mean, they sent us to lower East Side, but for me to say, I mean, I think we were lucky that they took us there, my mother lived in the same project. She passed away 61 years, and when the truck came, the van, and they put a body inside the van to take her upstate in New York. It was like my mother last stop. She left the project where she raises, and to me, we were lucky that we came from Lake Tennessee to live there, because it was a beautiful world living there. Was a lot of stuff happening, but for me, the teachers and the support system in the music program is what made that special for me to live there, and it made me a better person in life. Like, I could have easily gone with gang shooting and arresting people and got in drugs and alcohol, and to this day, I never drank or smoked, because at an early age I knew that was wrong to do. And even the college I see every year would tell me, if you get into drugs, alcohol, you can forget about your life. And he was right. I never drank and smoked. So when I went to New York Presbyterian, I really have my second life, because I had that major heart surgery like 10 years ago. So, and I asked him for the operation. I said, "Dr. Girardi, can you guarantee me I want to live?" He goes, "Look, Miguel, I'll be honest with you. A lot of people, they make it and they don't. And I cannot promise you're going to make it. But I do know one thing. We do this operation many, 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 many times. And all I could tell you is, I'll do my best." And that's what he did. And I was lucky, because the operation have a lot of people don't make it through. So the music really, even now, it takes me a long way. There's a famous composer named Gustav Mahler, and he's a prolific composer, and his second symphony is called the Resurrection Symphony, and it's a 1 hour piece long, but the last movement he talks about, and he dedicated the whole symphony, because he had two daughters at an early childhood that died of a heart problem. So he created a symphony about saying that when you die, your life keeps going on. And when you hear the orchestra and the chorus at the end, you feel that that, you know, that present, that when you die, your life goes on. So what I really want to do is, in my mother's, you know, birthday, she's going to be placed in the church, and then she gets buried. You know, we're going to skip the traditional, you know, the viewing and all that. My friends are going to play music for her. And then we're all going to speak, but I want to just to play like the last four minutes of Mahler's, you know, Second Symphony. And it talks about, you know, when you die, you go to heaven. And when you die, you never die, because your life continues. It keeps going. It never stops. And when the orchestra play, you know, you feel it and you see it, and it's very powerful. And that's something that I want to have the audience know, that this is where my mother is. And I want to play that and say she died, but she keeps moving. We're still here, but she keeps moving. And that's why, that's to me why, you know, like I cried or whatever when I listen to Mahler's music. He gives me a better understanding and foundation that, you know, that this is part of life and you got to keep going. And, you know, it's, and I just felt that, you know, I was blessed to have a mother like mine. She was very strong. You know, we didn't have a father. We were raised with belts and bats and slaps and none of that. But she told, you know, we were all boys, and there were a lot of boys, and we were tough, you know. So she had to put us in place. But the nice thing was that we came from rough behavior, but we all did well. And I want to let you know that there were thousands of families there too that had great kids. And many people talk bad about these poor neighborhoods, and that's not true. There are millions of families, and they're good friends. We know good values, but. Well, I had the different ones. I had the support system, my music teacher, the Henry Street Solomon, the New York, the university, the Juilliard, the Masculine Music. I had that special privilege, you know, to go through that path, through the music, because the music took me there. And I could have been, you know, in the streets and all that. So my brother became a director of a big rehab in New York. My sister became the director of Helen Hayes. My brother Harry is a junior high school teacher, and he hasn't retired for 40 years. And then my younger sister, she has her own coffee business. Her name is Lisa, and that was my Miss White was her grandma, mother. And then there was me. I didn't really finish school, but I felt that in my lifetime that, you know, that I have what they call the University of the Streets, and I just felt that, you know, that I learned a lot, and I had special opportunity, and the tuba took me to many places where I could never go. And when I went to the first time to Juilliard School, the orchestra is what made me feel that you're home. It's the sound of the orchestra. This is where I grew up. So that's why I got the connection that I crossed him about.
Yeah.
I hope I didn't bore you, but.
Oh my gosh, no. I'm so glad to be able to hear the story and all the places that you've gone to and about your family. Yeah. Do you still have any family connection to the Lower East Side?
Oh yeah, we a lot of families and all that. In fact, I'm meeting with them because I told the executive director of the Henry Street Solomon that I love to be on the board. So they know I work there. They know my story, like the same stuff I told you, and they told me they would love to have me on the board, because they told me that you are a product of the neighborhood. You live here, you work here, and all that, you know, and you have an amazing story. So I'm in the process now, like in a couple of weeks, they're going to make me some kind of board member. I told them that I know you're looking for financial stuff, but I could help you develop programs and make this place better. I'll give you a short example.
Yeah.
The Hendrick has an arts building. It's called the Armin Arts Building. And his music and art. Now, many years ago, when I was there, they had orchestra stuff and all that. Now that's all gone. So I wrote them a letter saying, look, you have a lot of Asians there. It's very important that you should start a Suzuki violin class. And that will bring a lot of the kids in, because playing the violin and music, it gives you, you know, your inner self a lot of strength. And you're able to, you know, to play and to share and to tell the world that this is your voice. So I'm trying to industry that they need to connect with the Julia and the Man School music, because they have, you know, youth program, and they need to connect and bring those programs to Lower East Side to share with all these troubled kids. Like I told them, they need to develop a music therapy program, because there's a lot of kids with many mental health problems, you know, special needs, and the music therapy will do wonders for these kids. So hopefully they'll put me on the board. But they told me they're very interested, and that's where I'm at. There. So
that's
my
great.
Mother passed, you know, I did something yesterday. Was I always had my mother cell, so I couldn't believe that she passed away. So I called her. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and she didn't answer. And she always did. Then that's when I realized, you know, she's gone, you know. But the only memory I have now is that she told me a lot of beautiful things, you know, in life. And, you know, I just felt that I was very lucky to have a mother like mine. Although we didn't have a father, our father had a Cadillac, had a boat, he had a trailer. And, you know, and he didn't really care for us. But my mother did, and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm very grateful for my teachers, for the music programs, for the welfare department, the industry, and all that. And also the housing projects who provide the subsidized for us to live there. And I was the last one to leave the projects. And there are many people don't like the projects, but I love the projects. I mean, a lot of great things happened. A lot of great people were there, you know. And I was very fortunate that I came up through that system.
Well, I'm really grateful that I was able to hear about you and your mother today.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the history that you've been part of creating, and your siblings too.
Yeah.
Well,
my mother, you know, made sure that we all did well, and everybody lives in great, great houses upstate New York and all that. My sister has a coffee business in California. She does great, and my sister Maggie was the main one who took care of my mother, like, in the past 6 months, because my mother was very independent for years. She was self, and what kept my mother alive, and this is the life. She was a salsa dancer. She loved to dance. And there's a summer festival they have every year, 116th Street, which is called in Spanish Harlem, the market, La Maqueta. And they have every Saturdays bands and DJ. And she went to all her friends and they danced for hours and hours. And that's what kept them young. Man, many times I would go places and they would tell my they would think that I'm a husband. I said, no, that's my mom. And it was a because my mother really looked young for age, although she was 91.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Anyways, thank you so much, and thank you for understanding and listening. I appreciate it. And what I'll do is, as soon as I find a picture of my family, I'll send it to you through email.
Yes, thank you. You can, that would be great. And or you can text it to me too. You have my number, I think.
And when you get a chance, I wish, you know, I was hoping, because I was the one who found information about you guys, and I shared with my family, and I was pushing my sister to get mom interview. And my mother was going to do it, but she's getting worse and worse, and she couldn't do it. So I think when you get a chance, speak to Maggie, because she can give you a lot of great information.
That would be great. Thank you so much. I'll be in touch over email, and I might ask you to help me with spelling for some of the places that you've been and the people that you mentioned, just in case, so they can be accurate and things like that. So great.
And thank you so much. And if you need anything, just let me know.
Okay.
I just hope that you get to speak to Maggie, and that, because that's the important part of the history.
Does she live in New York City?
She has an apartment in New York City and upstate New York.
Okay.
So, but if you want, I could send you through email, a number and an email. That way you could talk to her.
Okay, yeah, that sounds good.
Okay. All right, thank you so much, Sarah, and have a nice day.
Thank you so much. Bye, Miguel.
Okay. Bye-bye.